Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Relationship Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Holly Wood, a marriage and family therapist, EMDR-trained trauma specialist, and clinical sexologist specializing in trauma, sex, and intimacy concerns. She's currently pursuing her PhD in human sexuality, focusing on sexual trauma and social justice. Holly works with couples and individuals to sort things out, let go of what does not serve them, and develop the necessary skills to achieve lifelong change to improve their quality of life. Thank you so much for joining me, Holly.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
So let's begin by just talking about what the common reasons are that couples seek out sex therapy.
Sure. So as a sex therapist, I see folks for a whole gamut of things from, you know, sexual anxiety, trauma, erectile disorders, different things like that. But the most common reason that I see couples is for what we call sexual desire discrepancy. And basically that means where one partner wants sex more frequently than the other. And so a lot of times I'll have a couple come in and they will say, oh, like I'm at a level 10. I can have sex 2 times a day if my partner would allow me, but my partner is at a level 2. So how can I dim mine down a little bit, or how can we get my level 2 to come up a little bit higher to my level 10?
And what are the factors that are impacting people's kind of sexual desires, and how do these mismatches happen?
Sure. So a lot of times when people come in with this conception of like, there's a certain number of times that they should be having sex, it's because they've done a Google search and they're trying to look for what is normal. So they see, okay, happy couples have sex X amount of times a week, according to some blog or something like that. And so when they see that they're not meeting that mark, they say, uh-oh, something must be wrong here. Not realizing that lack of desire or desire changes throughout the lifespan, where sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower, can change. So some different things that impact desire discrepancy is, number one, a lack of understanding due to what we see in the media, what we see portrayed in movies, romantic comedies, and other things like that. As well as cultural factors, different things, our friends talking, right? We hear our friends talking about how much sex they're having. So we think, uh-oh, we're not having sex that much. Maybe there's something wrong here. So that's a big part of it. I think it's also important to understand that sexual desire, there are different levels of sexual desire. So a lot of times I get folks who come in and go, oh, I have a low libido and my partner has a high libido. How do I get mine up to meet my partner's, or vice versa? So I think it's important to understand that there are 3 types of sexual desire. So Emily Nagoski describes 3 in her book, Come As You Are, one of which is spontaneous desire. So spontaneous desire, exactly what it sounds like, right? You get that spontaneous feeling. Some folks call it horniness. They say, I don't know the right word to say, so I'm just going to call it horny. Okay, well, that makes sense. So some folks do experience what we call spontaneous desire, that instant without stimulation feeling of wanting to have sex. Unfortunately for women, men are the lucky ones who get to experience that more frequently. So research shows us close to 75% of men experience the spontaneous desire, as well as 15% of women. However, where does that leave everybody else? So there's 2 other types of desire that I think are really important to understand. One of which is responsive. So responsive, again, is responding to a stimulus, right? A lot of times I talk to folks about revving the engine. What do we do to get you to a place of feeling desire? And especially for women, 30% of women experience what we call responsive desire, where it's responding to, you know, a physical or a mental stimulus that turns us on and gets us in the mood to say, okay, now I'm ready. I want to have sex. And yet there's still some folks left out. So that other portion of desire is what we call contextual sexual desire. So where our desire is dependent on the context. A lot of times when I meet folks, I ask about, you know, the sexiest times they've had together, and they'll say, oh, we went on this vacation. We were in Hawaii or Cabo, and we were in this new place. It was just the two of us. The kids weren't around. And those are the contexts in which like the really spicy stuff happens. So for myself, I always go back to like deadlines, diapers, and dishes. And so most of us, when we think about sexual desire, if I know for myself, for a lot of folks, if I have a work deadline, if I have a sink full of dirty dishes and my kid needs a diaper change, the last thing on my mind is going to be sex.
Absolutely.
Right. So thinking about those contexts, so a lot of folks also experience what we call contextual sexual desire, whereas it depends on the context, and there are different things that can either damper our sexual desire, right? If your kid's in the next room or you're really full because you just had a really good meal, versus other things that can increase our level of desire, like being in a beautiful hotel alone, no kids, no stresses of regular work life when you're on vacation. So one factor that contributes to a desire discrepancy is people have different levels of desire. So if a couple is experiencing different levels of libido or sex drive, it could be because one person in the couple has more of a spontaneous desire where they just feel it on a whim, whereas another person maybe needs some sort of stimulus to respond to, or needs all the stars to align as far as contextual desire is concerned.
I love that you just named all those very explicitly, because in the background, I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, I know I have spontaneous desire, but then responsiveness as well. But then like the context chips away at that all day long, right? And I can't be the only person watching this that feels the same way, right? So even if you're, firing in all cylinders, for lack of a better analogy, life just tends to be taxing, right? And, my partner loves to say that, like, I am at my most desiring at like 2 p.m., right? Which is not a great time. And then the entire evening transpires. And by the time we're finally alone and the opportunity presents itself, I'm like, you are the last person I need right now. Like, please do not come at me. Right. So these are kind of some of the simple desire discrepancies that we're talking about on the simplest level. There can also just be, as you said, like actual drive and libido mismatching. Mm-hmm. If you could expand a little bit on that, is that the spontaneous and responsive and contextual play into libido as well? Or is that more of a kind of a biological and physical?
Right. So libido is more of a medicalized term. So when I look at like libido, like physiological arousal, I think about other factors that play a role. For example, I mostly, as a clinician, get folks who are experiencing what they present to me with is, I have low libido, right? Mm. And this is somebody coming to me off the street who's, coming to me as an expert, as a sex therapist, basically self-diagnosing, well, I don't want to have sex, so it must be that I have low libido. That could be the case. There are physiological and biological factors that impact low libido, such as medications, different types of antidepressants, especially. But I think it's also to really take a look at those three different types of desire and see, like, is it really a biological concern, or is it the fact that my kids are in the room next door and I'm also dealing with the stress that is a global pandemic, right? There's other stressors outside of the physiological. The other thing might be the ability to manage stress in response to stressors. So certain things like the kids are probably always going to be there, at least until they're 18 and sometimes past that, and that's okay. But they're a constant stressor, right? They also provide lots of other great things in our lives. But as far as sex is concerned, they're a block, right? So I also work with clients on, okay, how are you managing your response to certain stressors that are going to be there continuously, right? There are always going to be kids in your house, or there are going to be kids in your house for a long period of time. How do you work around that? How do you still have a close, loving, sexually connected relationship with your spouse, despite that you both have children?
Exactly. Because you can't just like wait it out, right? We can't wait 25 years till the youngest one's out of the house to reconnect to our intimacy.
Exactly. Some other things I think about when it comes to desire discrepancy, in addition to some of the physiological factors, I always check, you know, what kind of medications are people on, what types of stress they're experiencing, external factors. I think about chronic negative interaction patterns between those involved in the couple. So in a relationship context, every couple experiences conflict. Across the board, nearly every couple is going to experience that. But what makes a difference is how folks recover from conflict. So I'm a firm believer that sex begins way before the two of you or more enter the bedroom, right? And so if we are fighting all day long, and then at the end of the day, we're expected to have sex with our partner, that's going to bleed into things. So sometimes it goes back, if a couple presents to me with, you know, oh, we have mixed match desire, and I found out, well, wow, they're also not agreeing on parenting styles, they're also not agreeing on household division of labor. Those are some other things that need to be addressed, so that way you two can better communicate and create more positive interactions. So that way, this is somebody that at the end of the day, you both want to connect with on a sexually intimate level.
And as you're talking, the thing that I actually just wrote it down, because the thing that keeps coming up when we're talking about managing stress, we're talking about conflict and communication, is safety, right? And sex is such an intimate, vulnerable, or can be a vulnerable experience. And if your fundamental sense of your safety is not met or is not being secure, then it's going to put up blocks in your body, in your heart, in your mind, right?
Right. And so, and it starts with, you know, not just physical safety, but like emotional safety, right? If you don't feel like you can express yourself emotionally to your partner in a way that feels safe, how are you then going to be able to translate to a space like sex, which is very vulnerable, right? How are you going to feel safe both emotionally, both and physically, intellectually, in a sexual space if you guys can't do that outside the bedroom? So, and again, safety, I think about like attachment bonds, right? When you interact with somebody sexually, it increases those attachment factors based on hormones, based on all those feel good hormones that cause us to attach, like oxytocin, vasopressin. And so if you don't feel like you can safely do that outside of the bedroom, how are you going to be able to do that within the bedroom?
Yeah, and actually, I've been listening to a podcast lately, and they had a sex episode, and the women that were talking about how they make their livings talking, right? And they talk all the time, and they're constantly expressing themselves. And then they've discovered that when they're in bed with their partner, that they are completely incapable of any like talking at all whatsoever. They can't say what they don't want. They can't say what they do want. They can't express pleasure, pain, like impossible. So there can be such a disconnect when it comes to that intimate act and being able to say what you want. So I imagine when it comes to something like a desire discrepancy, that just the act of talking it out and actually bringing it to your partner, like often I'm sure when you see couples that all they're able to say is that we have a problem, right? And that they don't know all these things that you've just named, and they don't even know how to have the conversations to lead to more intimacy.
Right. And so communication is such a big factor in across different areas of relationships, but in sex as well. And when we talk about communicating sexually, again, sex can be a taboo topic. It's something that's especially vulnerable. And so people can find it difficult to even talk about sex and talk about those body parts. So what I found a lot of times in therapy is that the most helpful thing is that they dedicate an hour or 90 minutes a week to talk about stuff that's hard to talk about. And so in doing so, you're able to create that bond, increase safety, so that eventually you get to a point of being able to do the act. But if you're wanting to do it without being able to talk about it, there's a, like a disconnect there, right? And a lot of times I'll talk to folks, they'll feel uncomfortable about talking about certain things. And I'm like, well, if you're adult enough to do it, why aren't you adults enough to talk about it?
Right.
It seems so simple, but also it's understandable that it's a difficult thing to talk about. It's something we don't go around talking about with our friends maybe as much as we could, or in other social spaces, because it can still be seen as quite taboo. But being able to be assertive about things that you notice in the bedroom that could be done differently are also ways to increase the connectedness that you have with your partner.
Absolutely. And going back to just what we've all had the shared experience of in different ways, but we've all had this pandemic shared experience. There's massive social issues and distress happening. And I know it's not down like straight gender or sex lines that this happens for females more than men. I mean, this is just as prevalent, I know, for a portion of men, but it feels like women in general, I'm overgeneralizing, need that talking connection and need to have kind of that verbal intimacy before we can disengage our brains and get into bed intimately with our partner or wherever it happens to happen.
I think what you're saying is somewhat of a generalization, but also like is research back to be true. Like when you think about the socialization of women are socialized to be the carers and to be the caretakers of social interactions. Like when you think about like, it's time to plan the holiday meal for that year. Generally, it's in heterosexual relationships, right? We're talking like heterosexually. Right, in those types of relationships, it's the woman-identified partner who takes it upon herself or is socially given the role to plan those things and to be the talker. So that definitely plays a role. I think it's also a lot of times I'll get is like people want to say something to their partner and they don't know how to say it without hurting their partner's feelings, hurting their partner's ego. Because on the flip side too, if we're talking like, for example, like we said, heterosexual couples, I think men tend to be socialized to be like the person who provides the pleasure, right? Like people talk about, is he doing it right? Like, is he doing X, Y, Z right? Like there's all different euphemisms we have for is the male partner able to please you? And that's a lot of pressure.
It is a lot of pressure. And statistically, speaking of research, like, and just circling back to what you said earlier about like how we've been socialized to think about sex and we've been socialized to think about sex as like a penis in a vagina, to be just like explicitly clear, right? And that's such an incredibly narrow and limited scope of what actually sex is. And what's possible for what sex is. And so to put the pressure on the penis in this example of like to satisfy someone when that's not how the majority statistically of women are able to reach climax, that's a lot, that's like a setup for disaster, it feels like.
And so I always encourage everyone to be in control of their own orgasm. Because there's also something really powerful about that, right? Like, why are you letting somebody else be in control of your orgasm? You take control of your orgasm. You know what you, figure out what you like on your own. Explore, play around, male, female body, doesn't matter. Non-binary, doesn't matter. But figure out what you like individually. So that way you get to a place to be able to share that with your partner. And again, a lot of times just the communication with your partner is the hardest part because we're scared of making someone feel bad or hurting somebody's ego, something like that. But I see all these opportunities for communication sexually, very similar to a lot of other issues that happen in relationships, whereas these are growth opportunities, right? Again, it's not about having conflict, but it's about how you resolve conflict. And how you confront a problem. I think a lot of folks think confrontation is a bad word, but really it means to face a problem head on. And so I encourage people to think about, you know, if something is happening sexually that is really important that they want to share with their partner, to think about a few things, you know, thinking about, is what I'm saying honest? Is what I'm saying kind? And is what I'm saying going to be helpful for the relationship? And to turn it on themselves. Right? People are afraid of saying, oh, you do this thing that doesn't make me feel great because we don't want to hurt the other person. But if we can turn it on ourselves and say, you know what, I feel uncomfortable when this happens, can we try it like this? It kind of turns it on yourself. And I think the other thing I always encourage people to do is to speak from the heart, because at the end of the day, if you are willing to have such a difficult conversation with somebody, that means to me that this is something really important to you, and you want to, as uncomfortable as it is, go through this conversation and efforts to make your relationship with this partner stronger and closer. And so approaching from that angle, as opposed to like not wanting to hurt someone's feelings, or actually, and some folks intentionally will say you do X, Y, and Z wrong, but from a place of, I feel this, this is really important to me, and I want us to get better at it. How can we do it differently? Is a really good place to start.
And it's such a great context too, because as with anything else, whether it be how you deal with finances or how you establish rules for your children and how you raise them, or anything, you know, how you're going to navigate your careers, especially if you both, if you're a dual career couple, it's like, mm-hmm. we're on the same team and we want mm-hmm. the same thing, which is for both of us to have a satisfying, fulfilling life in any of those areas, for us to mm-hmm. create a sense of calm and connection in our home. And so this is just yet another one of the things that we're going to talk about in order to do that. And that mm-hmm. having those tough conversations to get to the other side, but having established, like, we're both on the same team. Ultimately, mm-hmm. we both want the same thing, which is for one another to be happy and fulfilled, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. And it makes me think of like communication styles. We always say, like, you know, to speak assertively, but what does assertive even mean? And when I think of communication right. styles, I think about whose needs are being met. And when you're speaking assertively, right, whereas passive aggressive or passive, you're honoring the other person, aggressive, you're honoring just yourself. When you're being assertive, you're honoring both people's needs. And so I love how you said that we're in this as a team. Like, look, I understand that you like this. I kind of like this, and I would like to try this. How can we meet in the middle? So that way right. both people's sexual needs are being met. And to bring it back to desire discrepancy, right? An example might be like, I get that you want to have sex every day, right? For myself, I can't do that when, again, I have deadlines, dirty dishes, and my baby needs a diaper change, but I want to be closer to you. Are there ways we can work through this? Can you help more with the dishes? And then I'd probably be more inclined to have sex more frequently, right? Yeah. This is an example. And if that works for you, great. And if not, there might be other ways to honor both people's needs.
Absolutely. So I want to talk definitely about how, you know, sexual needs, desires change over the course of a lifetime, because it's definitely not something that people talk about. We all know about kind of the beginning stages and the fiery mm-hmm. desire and intimacy that every, you know, helps people fall in love in the first place. And then the first years, and everybody's familiar with kind of, you know, the rough spots that can happen when you bring a baby home, but nobody talks about like the rest of your life. mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. so many things happen throughout the course of a life that can affect your desire and mm-hmm. the desire that you have for and with your partner.
Mm-hmm. Right. So just thinking at, as far as like the life stages, like what you said is very true. A lot of times couples come in and they say, well, at the beginning, you know, we were having sex on the countertops, doing it everywhere all the time. And it was so hot and fiery. And right, because it's a new situation, you two are, it's those sparks are flying. You two are getting to know each other, doing exciting things, exploring things together for the first time, which makes sense. So if you think about how sex changes throughout the lifespan on top of other factors that happen throughout the lifespan, it becomes more clear. Well, no wonder things aren't the same, you know, in your late 40s, early 50s that they were in your early 20s, right? So I think it's really important also that folks know that that change is normal and that there are ways to work with it. So research shows most folks are serial monogamists, whereas we're in long-term relationship followed by long-term relationships. You know, for those of us who want or and are lucky enough, we're in one relationship for a very long time. But for the most part, we're what we consider serial monogamists. And so if you look at some research by Fisher in particular, you can see that there's generally three stages of falling in love and then eventually parting ways until you're done with one relationship to move on to the next monogamous relationship. And so the first relationship is called being in love, right? And so that relationship is characterized by that high energy, that emotion, that passion, and a little bit of stress because it's something new and we want to make sure we're doing things right. Whereas the next stage, but that stage only it lasts like what, 6 months, right?
Right.
So then we go to the next stage, which is passionate love, right? So we still have that high passion, but our stress is minimized a little bit. Going back to the biological basis of now we've known this person for 6+ months. We've had those experiences to build attachment. We've built closeness through release of those biological hormones like oxytocin, vasopressin, all those good feeling hormones that make us feel connected and safe with somebody. And then we move to stage 3 of a relationship, which we call companionate love, right? And so a lot of times I'll get folks who've been married for 20 years and they'll say, well, we're like roommates now, or like friends. I like him, we're friends, but we're not, it's not as fiery as it used to be. And so this is because, again, those hormones have had more time to sink in place for safety. Something that happens at the beginning is it's a little risky, right? Which can cause an increase in the feelings of eroticism because it's like, ooh, it's something new, it's exciting, it's risky. Whereas when we feel really close and safe with somebody, we know that they're not going to go anywhere. We feel secure in the relationship that we have. We've had a long period of time for those good feeling hormones to set in and make us feel securely attached. So these are like the 3 main stages that happen in relationships, which makes sense when you think about sex. So what happens when you go from, you know, stage 1, stage 2 to stage 3? Generally, when we're moving from, you know, like the being in love to the passionate love. So when we first start to like really say, okay, we're a couple now, like this is, we're committed to each other. And then when we go to companionate love, a lot of times in couples, like you said, we focus on raising families. We focus on financial stability. We focus on emotional stability. We're making sure that our kids are going off to school and meeting their developmental milestones. They're well taken care of. But then that excitement kind of tapers down. So how do we maintain passion in domesticity? So what we do is, I think the first part is naming these things, right? That it's natural. Biologically, you're biologically geared to go through these changes. So it is normal, as in every sense of the word normal, right? I try to stay away from normal and tell folks, you know, normal is a setting on the washing machine. But like, right, as far as like realistically, your body is biologically
it's geared common to interact. It's typical, right?
Typical is the word, exactly. Typical for that to happen. So I think a lot of times folks find comfort in realizing that this is a typical thing, right? We all experience this throughout the lifespan. We all go through those stages. So then once we're in the space of companionate love and we're in a more domestic environment, how do we create passion? Part of it is to prioritize the time that you have together relationally. So when we're in that companionate love stage, we're a lot of times we're focused on, you know, getting the kids to school on time, making sure everybody's fed, and putting money into our 401ks, which are all very important things. But it leaves things like what were happening in the beginning stages, that dating, right? That passion, that prioritization of the couple itself. Anticipation
and excitement, all of those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So part of it is to plan those things, right? I know it might seem silly to some folks to plan those things, but I'll also say, like, if you have a concert coming back when we could go to concerts, right?
I was going to say, it's gotten so much more challenging now, right? Like,
right.
It's so hard to plan a date when you can't go anywhere and nothing feels safe. Yeah.
Exactly. But it's a prioritization. Right. So even if you think about those times when we were like young and broke, like financially, right, we couldn't do like
be more creative.
Had to be more creative. It shows that you prioritize the relationship, right? So sometimes it might be something that's, less expensive, also more safe in the midst of a global pandemic, like a picnic on the balcony of your own home, right? But it shows that you're prioritizing those things, right? I said concerts because it would be like some people are averse to scheduling sex or date nights, right?
Right.
But if you're planning, if you bought tickets to a concert and the concert's not like till 6 months away, when the concert comes, does it make it any less exciting that you bought a ticket 6 months ago?
Right.
Not really. but it's about prioritizing the relationship. So some of it might need to bring awareness or consideration and creation of opportunities to where you can get away from the domestic tedium and into a place of eroticism, like, you know, planning when the kids are going to be away at summer camp or this is happening. How can we, how can we really utilize this moment that we have together to prioritize our time in our relationship? Aside from scheduling sex, couples can engage in novel activities outside of the bedroom that remind them of those exciting times. Again, you think about the beginning stages and trying new restaurants together or trying new activities together. And they're new because you haven't, even if you've done them before, you haven't done them with this person before, right? So it goes to your notion of creativity, finding things outside of the bedroom to build excitement and increase that closeness and anticipatory excitement for things within the bedroom, like trying new restaurants, taking romantic trips, again, just prioritizing the relationship itself. In doing those things, you go back to the biological basis of raising that oxytocin, raising those dopamine levels, all of those things that are associated with security, reward, and excitement, which again play into why sex was so good in the beginning.
Right. And I, so, as you were talking, I was thinking about like even the very, very tiny, simplest things, because, you know, it's been an 18 months of, you know, us all trying to carve out our own time and things. Mm-hmm. And my kids have learned, my kids are like middle school age, and they've learned that after a certain hour, unless it's urgent, like an emergency, that they just don't bother us. We're like, this is our time. And they know, and they're not going to catch us in an intimate moment or anything, but it's more of like, this is our time together without you guys. And we're, you know, it, to them, it just looks like we're watching TV, but we're rubbing each other's feet or we're talking about our day or doing all of these connective activities that are just important to us. Because when we're all home 24 hours a day for 900 days in a row, it's hard to create, we're all enmeshed. We're all in each other's space. So it's so hard to create that. So that's been our thing. It's just been like after 9 p.m., like, we don't care if you go to sleep, but you're not, we're not on the clock anymore. We punched out. This is our time. And it's easier to do once your children are a little bit older, obviously, but yeah, just kind of preserving that.
Yeah. And I think that's so important. I think a lot of people get, like, especially moms, you know, they'll feel guilty for not being present for their kid for a certain period of time. But I think about, like, you know, eventually, if you've done your job right, that eventually the kids are going to leave the nest, right? And then you're back at home with just your spouse. And like doing little things like that is modeling to your child about how to have an appropriate adult relationship beyond having kids. My stepdaughter's 18, so she's a little bit older than yours, but there's still times where I say, hey, do you mind if I take your dad out on a date tonight? Because I want to prioritize the time that we have, but also show respect for my stepdaughter. And so there are ways to do those things. And for me, that's showing her, modeling to her that my relationship with her dad is very important, but also my relationship to her is important. And I want to honor that too. If for some reason she needed me tonight, we can maybe figure out something else, but also honoring the relationship I have with her father. So I think that that's really, really important. And I love hearing how you do that with your kids.
And, you know, we kind of talked about like chemically what's going on, but there's also just, and beyond like the kind of connective and, you know, beginning hormones of relationship, there's also literally just like hormone issues, like estrogen and progesterone and testosterone and all of the changes that women and men go through as they age, not to mention the body changes that we go through from giving birth and et cetera. It's a lot. And it, of course there's going to be periods of change. And I love to tell people, like, you know, when my son was really young, he had colic, and it was the first time that I was very aware of my tendency to, like, catastrophize and forever stuff, right? Like, this is my life forever now. I'm doomed to this purgatory of a screaming infant, right? So it's easy for us to, if when we're encountering difficulty because of the stress load, is to just be like, oh, we're never having sex again, or we're never going to get that intimacy back, or the fire is gone, or that thing is gone. And I just love to encourage people to just be like, no, this is now, and we're going to actively work to get it back, or we're going to address some of those hormonal issues that we might be going through or experiencing. We're going to, you know, make sure our bodies are being taken care of, et cetera.
Right. It makes me think about, there's, I hate the name, but it's called, like, the good enough sex model. And I think there's a lot of value to it. Like, the name sounds scary, but I think there's a lot of value to it, and normalizing that things are different, right? You mentioned the hormone changes, but there's also life stuff that happens, whether it's because you are pregnant, or you just had a child, or God forbid you lose a family member, or you're dealing with financial stress because one of you lost a job. There are all these different environmental factors that play a role in our experience of sexual intimacy. And so I think I encourage folks to think about, okay, well, you're not, you know, 20 years old with not a lot of responsibility and no kids around. So there's a difference, but what is good enough for you now? What would be reasonable for you now with children in the home and dealing with the stress that you have? What is good for now? So I think a lot of times we like look to this pedestal of what we had when we were in those states of, like, less stress and more excitement, but things change. And so I think normalizing that plays a huge role in people feeling comfortable with changes in sex throughout the lifespan.
Yeah. Looking at your life and your intimacy is kind of like seasons. That's, it's like, okay, so this is the way we're riding now. I remember probably 2 or 3 years ago, the moment, I remember the day, I remember what the light was like outside, I remember the temperature, when I realized that my sons were not I didn't have to watch them in my yard anymore, right? They weren't going to dart into the street anymore. They were actually autonomously safe, objectively. And like the load of stress that lifted from my person of not having, and I have sons, and this is not a male or female thing, but my experience has been that boys are actively trying to end their lives constantly over and over again, just through their experience and exploration of the world. And so just the stress that lifted, and I looked at my partner and said, oh my gosh, we're in a different season now. We've arrived. We can let go of some of this.
And so I think about, again, how can you prioritize yourselves as a couple, whatever season you're in?
Yeah, absolutely. So how do couples fix these desire discrepancies? I know we've talked a little bit about it, but let's say somebody's watching this video and they've acknowledged it to themselves, maybe while they're watching this, but they're at the beginning stages of trying to talk through it with their partner. What would you recommend as first steps? And then what do you see as, like, their plan?
Sure. So I think it's a big question, but the short answer is understanding, right? And so some of it we've talked about, you know, understanding that there is no normal, that there are a lot of factors that influence desire, and then it's likely to change throughout your lifespan. Understanding that changes in the lifespan are rooted in biology, and so that there is that factor as well. It's not necessarily something about you that is problematic, but it's that your body's reacting in the way that it's supposed to do biologically. And then the other part is understanding your partner. So I always say, like, my therapeutic remedy is to generate compassion for each partner's position. So, for example, the low desire partner might feel guilty for not engaging in sex as much as the higher desire partner might. And then the higher desire partner might feel unwanted because their partner isn't willing to engage as often or doesn't want to connect in that way as often. But once you are able to address those things and effectively communicate about what's going on, a lot of times you'll see that that's not the case. For example, the higher desire partner who feels not wanted might not see, oh, wow, well, they've also been doing X, Y, and Z, or they're really stressed right now and it has nothing to do with me. And so being able to communicate about those things and where you're at and then understand from your partner is crucial. That is the most important thing. So having these difficult conversations. And I go back to, you know, the ways that we can communicate to our partners about these things. For a lot of folks, communicating about sex is the hardest part. Right. So being comfortable with the uncomfortable, using things like I statements, you know, I feel X, Y, or Z. If I'm a higher desire partner, you know, if I feel like you don't want me because X, Y, and Z happens, what can we do? You know, that turns it on you, as opposed to you're not having sex with me. There's something wrong.
Right, right. Or questioning your own stories, right? Like, my story about the fact that we're not having sex is this. And and when you were talking, what occurred to me is that in both of the examples that you gave, or that one partner has large desire and the other one doesn't, is that they might have in common a feeling of like shame, right? They both might feel ashamed. I feel ashamed because I don't want to. The other partner feels ashamed because of the level of their desire, or because they're not, they feel like they're unwanted. And so they, you both have the same feeling for different reasons, and how connecting and unifying it might feel to discover like, oh, wait, we're both feeling the same. Let's figure out how we can move through that.
Right. And we counteract shame by living in our truth and being authentic with what's coming up. And so who better do that with than your partner? So again, be inquisitive, ask questions, don't assume, use those I statements. I tell folks to be honest, be gentle, be empathetic, and speak from the heart. Because again, I think if you're at the point where you want to have such a difficult conversation, and for everyone who's tuning into the conference today, that tells me that their relationships are probably really important in their lives and they want to work on those. And so coming from that place of, this is important to me, I know it's really hard to talk about, but I want us to get better at this. How can we work together collaboratively so that both of our needs are met? I mean, it lets your partner know that you're willing to move through the discomfort, you're willing to be vulnerable, and that the motivation is because you want your relationship to be better.
Right, exactly. Same team, right?
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. If people want to hear about more about you and your work, where can they find you?
So they can find me at hollywoodmft.com. They can also find me at Instagram on The Hollywood Sexologist. Those are probably the best ways to contact me for therapy services or anything else.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for being with us today.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.